Hello and
Hey.
welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I am a writer, actor, and comedian. And if you would like to support the podcast, please go to buymeacoffee.com/required reading. Every little bit helps. Our guest today is Kelsey Buckley. She is a Master's of Social Work student at the Erickson Institute studying infant and early childhood mental health. She's based in Chicago, and in the coming years, she hopes to become licensed as a registered play therapist and open her own private practice in the city. Kelsey has her BFA in acting from Texas State University and likes to call herself a retired actor. But if you're listening to this and happen to be casting a production of Annie, please consider this her formal submission for the role of Miss Hannigan. In her free time, you can catch her making her own Play-Doh, riding her e-bike to school, counseling internship, and hosting house parties with her cool husband, Jack. Hello!
Hi, Erin.
You and your husband, Jack, actually invited me to my very first like Twitter group message that re like genuinely I don't know if I would have like my career that I do now without, and there are certainly a lot of friends I wouldn't have. Like Carly O'Brien has been on the show so many times and I wouldn't know
I
her
am
without
Carly
you. So
O'Brien's number one fan. It is a really interesting time in life to reflect on that, like, early Twitter group chat era, and we made a lot of really wonderful friends. And God, now the site is just a flaming hell pit. And was it great at the time? No, but it continues to get worse in a way that I really didn't think that it could.
yeah, I logged on recently only for like gossip purposes and then logged on
That's
promptly after.
Yeah, that's like pretty much all it's good for anymore. Logging on, seeing some drama, and being like, all right, cool.
Yeah, but I guess it's time. Our book
It is time.
today is from 1943 by Antoine Saint-Exupéry. I looked this up. Exupéry, The Little Prince.
The Little Prince. So my story with this book is that I actually first read it in French. I studied French between 7th and 10th grade, and then I picked it back up in undergrad, and I studied it for like 3 years there as well. But when I was in 7th grade, we were assigned Le Petit Prince in my French class. And, I didn't like read it cover to cover, but like we worked on it as a class. And that was the first way that I consumed the story. And like I really enjoyed the book, but it also just felt so like fancy and grown up that I was reading a book in a different language, especially like it being French felt just like so posh. And so I read that in French in 7th grade and then actually was assigned the English translation in 9th grade. So I don't think I actually read it that time because I was like, I know this, but I do have like my English copy. I never had a French copy, but I do have my tried and true. I think that, like probably like my sister and brother like handed it down to me. But yes, I mean, this story, it has always meant a lot to me. I do have a Little Prince tattoo. I have the boa constrictor inside.
Perfect. With the elephant. Yeah.
With the elephant, I considered getting the boa constrictor outside as the tattoo, but I was like, grown-ups are never gonna get it.
That's true.
So that's my history with it.
Oh, I love that. I knew about this book always, and I took French for, I guess, 5 years on and off between 7th and 12th. And it never came up. It was never in our
Wow.
curriculum. I never read it. So it was really nice to finally get to dive into it. And the thing I was most surprised by is that with it not being a part of my childhood, the thing that blows my mind is my dad is a pilot. Like my dad loves
Wow.
planes. He loves planes. So I don't know how. But we didn't have this. Like my parents live in Maryland. In our suburb, there's like a little tiny flight strip. And they're everywhere. And so my dad will, anytime he hears a plane, and his hearing is not good except for planes, he'll run to the window and look out and name the plane and be like, "Oh, it's a
Oh
B-52.
my
It's Conan."
gosh.
Every time. He used to be a flight instructor and do these discovery flights and be like, "Do you want to see what it's like to be in a two-person plane? Let's go for an hour." So it's bizarre that I've never read this.
Yeah, that is certainly, yeah, that's interesting to have studied French, to have a pilot dad. I know that my mom definitely read it as a child. I don't think my dad ever brought it up, and like my mom never like commented on it too terribly much when I was reading it. She wasn't like, "Oh, I love that one," or anything like that. But like, I know that she had read it. It's a classic for a reason, I feel. When I read it in seventh grade, and my French teacher told us the story of how he had actually survived a plane crash, I like didn't believe it. I was like, "No, this is just something that y'all tell kids so that we'll read it." But like, that is a really crazy, amazing story. It just
Yeah,
adds
let's
so
talk
much
about
texture.
him.
Please.
Yeah. So Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, we hope that's it, was a French pilot who was, from an aristocratic family, but I think they had kind of, early 20th century fallen into someone was gambling somewhere probably in there. So he was a pilot for a really long time. He was, I think, one of the pioneers of international postal flight in the days when aircraft had few instruments. So he dies the year after this comes out. He actually disappears over the Sahara. His plane goes missing. But before then, he had sort of made comments of like, the more like scientific and technologically advanced these planes are getting, the less cool pilots are getting. We're becoming like accountants, I think was the comparison. But when World War II starts, obviously, but in 1940, Germany occupies France and occupies Paris. And at that point, he was living in exile in the US. He had been a pilot. He wanted to keep flying for this war effort. And they were like, "You are simply too old and you are in bad health." And he's like, "I don't care." And he like makes it really his mission to try to persuade the US to enter the war. He also lost his dad when he was 4 years old. His younger brother died when the brother was 15 and he was 17. So at a very young age, he becomes sort of the father of the family. And there's even when his younger brother Francois was on his deathbed, he told Antoine, "Don't worry, I'm all right. I can't help it. It's just my body," which a lot of people compare to the Little Prince's last
The Little
words, which we can
Prince,
come back to. And so he, as a postal worker, his duties included negotiating the safe release of downed flyers taken hostage by Saharan tribes. He received a Legion d'honneur from the French government in 39. And when he's in North America, he goes between like New York and I think Quebec. He's really ill. He's depressed. Like all of his friends are back in France fighting the good fight. This book is dedicated to Leon Worth, who was this French Jewish anti-bourgeois anarchist who was still living in France and like fighting the good fight. And one of the wives of one of Antoine's publishers said, "You are so depressing and sad. You should try to write a kid's book." And
Oh,
so
wow.
he, and apparently at the same time, they're also, I don't think anyone says this to him, but they're also like, "Mary Poppins is selling like hotcakes, and it would like be really great if we could, try to go in on that market. It would be helpful." And like you're talking about, this work is partially based on a crash. He and his navigator survived in the Libyan desert. They were stranded and dehydrated for 4 days and miraculously stumbled upon a Bedouin who gave them water and wrote later that this guy saved their lives and gave them charity and magnanimity by bearing the gift of water. So I think first off, I want to just spend a minute with that introduction because it's immediately, I was like, "Holy, holy crap! What is this I'm opening?"
I think that the dedication is like honestly one of my favorite parts. Because, as somebody who works with kids, who hopes to work with kids in an even like deeper capacity. This just like really speaks to me. I ask children to forgive me for dedicating this book to a grown-up. I have a serious excuse. This grown-up is the best friend I have in the world. I have another excuse. This grown-up can understand everything, even books for children. I have a third excuse. He lives in France where he is hungry and cold. He needs to be comforted. If all these excuses are not enough, then I want to dedicate this book to the child whom this grown-up once was. All grown-ups were children first, but few of them remember it. So I correct my dedication to Leon Worth when he was a little boy. I just think that is so beautiful.
This might be the first time I've cried on the pod. Yeah, that's, I didn't cry when I read it the first time, but that's so, especially knowing that when he says, Worth is hungry and cold, like it's occupied France and he is a Jewish anarchist.
Yes,
Like to
it's
say he
just
is hungry.
to say, like, this man was once a child, and now he has grown up, and this is what his life has amounted to. I think that that's something that I kind of try to go back to in my own life of like when I am like struggling with, like empathy for certain people, all those things. It's like, at what point? You were 3 years old. I think that that is so powerful and wonderful. Something that I say a lot is magic is real when you're a child because childhood is magical. And I think that that's just like such a perfect introduction to like the story that you're about to
And
just.
Worth was, I think, 22 years older than Saint-Exupéry. He was really like especially in terms of writing, like kind of a father figure. And he didn't find out that Exupéry died until the year after, like he found out in the newspaper that his friend had died and didn't, the book hadn't, I don't think the book had been released yet in France. It was published in the US in both English and French. And because they were occupied, I don't think it got to France yet at that point.
Gut wrenching, like.
And I really love any book where the author is also the illustrator. I just started reading Charlie and the Chocolate Factory today for next week's episode.
Oh my God, I can't wait to listen to that.
And that, unless I'm wrong, I don't think those are Roald Dahl's illustrations. I think they must have worked together a lot, but I don't think that's actually him. And yet,
I
like, I
believe
have
that they
those.
it's just like so ingrained in my brain, like those that like that style of illustration. God, the illustrations in those Roald Dahl books are like almost the best part.
Yeah, that's
And
going to be a good chat.
yes, but the illustrations in this book as well are just like, I love how they're not very good. Like, I think that it's so wonderful how they're pretty ugly. They're not necessarily very well done. He is not an artist, as he says, he only really knows how to draw a boa constrictor inside and outside. It's a little bit juvenile almost, in a way that I think is very fitting.
Yeah, there's something really nice about children's books that look like they were illustrated by children. Like it's, and it can't always be like that, but there's, it's really nice. And there's a quote somewhere where he's sort of doodle. Oh, here. He's, I think one day he's sort of like drawing or doodling and draws the prince's face and it sort of looks up at him and he's like, oh, that's my character. Like there's this little face now and he's gonna tell me his story rather than, yeah, anything else. And there's this one line that I loved. He's talking about the writing process. He devoted himself to the book on mostly midnight shifts, usually starting at about 11 p.m., fueled by helpings of scrambled eggs on English muffins, gin and tonics, Coca-Colas, cigarettes, and numerous visits by friends, which I loved.
Oh, that's great.
I love the idea of like someone sitting down to write a children's book and like Hemingway chucking back scotches. I don't know. There's something very, very perfect about that.
I know. I'm like, God, scrambled eggs on an English muffin. I'm like, God, that I could actually really go for that right now. Throw one back for Antoine tonight.
Leon Worth, I think the only other thing I know about him is he called him Tony or Tonio, which I think is so
Oh, I love
nice.
that. I love when like you know a famous person by their famous person name and then like somebody else refers to them like with like familiarity. That just feels so like, I don't know, just like very sweet.
And so I think the first thing that I have is there's this talk repeatedly about grown-ups don't really understand things without explanation. There is this sort of, because the prince also has a habit of questioning, but can also, you already mentioned sort of the grown-ups don't understand everything, if there's just something you'd like to talk about there.
Yeah, I think that play is so integral and important. And like a book that I've read more recently, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin, I'm not sure. But there's like the line in there where he says, like, play is the most intimate act that you can engage another person in. And I think that that is so wonderful and so true. And I think that as a former preschool teacher, I would sometimes hear like kids would. There was one point when a kid asked me, like, do you have any trains at home? Like we were playing with trains and he said, I have trains at home. And I was like, yeah. And he goes, do you have any trains at home? And my first impulse was to say, no, I'm a grown up and I don't really play with trains. And then I was like, oh my God, how horrible. Like, of course grown ups can play. And so that's what it always reminds me of. It's just this kind of like, once you're grown up, you kind of forget the way that things were and like the very real nature of like play is real. You know, I can draw a picture of a sheep and now I have a sheep. That's what it reminds me of is like the fact that grown-ups have kind of forgotten how to play.
Yeah, I liked that there's this line that children should always show great forbearance towards grown-up people. They're not going to get it right away, so just give them some time and give them some patience and give them some understanding.
It's like, listen, I know they're frustrating, right?
Yes. Which is so good. And anytime you can have a kid at least believe that they are doing a favor to an older person, I think is so. Yeah, I mean, we talk a lot on the show about just like how frustrating it can be to be a kid because there's so much out of your control and there's so much you don't understand and there's so much
Absolutely.
so that there's a degree to which you can read it as patronizing, but it's also like, no, like we're giving them a leg up in a hard world, in a world made for full-size people. Yeah.
Right. It's like childhood is something that everyone experiences and then like immediately forgets. And people have so little patience for children. Like, I feel like there's constantly discourse online about like babies on airplanes and kids at restaurants. And it's like, guys, they just got here. They just got here. And also, you did this too. People say things like, I hate kids. They're so annoying. It's like, oh, yeah, because you were a fucking barrel of laughs.
Perfect. I don't interact with kids. I don't really plan on ever becoming a parent, but I do really like parenting TikToks every now and again because I think it just like puts things in a lot of context. Like someone was talking about like my baby won't stop crying because it has gas. And I was like, "Oh yeah, actually, if you've never had to fart before, you've never had a stomach ache before and you're 0 days old, what the heck is that?" Yeah,
You're
that
crazy.
makes sense. It
That's
really
something
does.
that I found myself constantly kind of explaining to parents when I was a preschool teacher is like, of course your kid is crying when you say that they can't get that new toy when you're walking through Target. That is literally the worst thing that's ever happened to them. And of course, you know, this is not to say that people don't go through like very real and very awful things when they are children. Unfortunately, that is, you know, part of life. But because of the way that the brain is like so plastic in the moment, developmentally, a lot of the time it kind of feels like the same experience for these little guys, you know? So like we gotta be patient with them, and they need to be patient with us.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you're trying to just say, like, let's all be a little kinder, we've all got things going on. Yeah.
We'll be right back after this.
Here they
come screaming across the sky. It's Lots and Lots of Jets and Planes, the greatest collection of aviation DVDs we've ever offered. And through this special TV offer, you can get two DVDs for the price of one. You'll get to see big planes, little planes, soaring stunt and passenger planes, even planes that fly real low. Old planes, new planes, fast planes, slow planes, smoking planes, even planes at supersonic speeds. Plus much, much more when you order Lots and Lots of Jets and Planes. Each DVD is jam-packed with lots of high-flying, close-up action. This special TV offer is not available in stores. Remember, you can get two DVDs, over 2 hours of non-stop aviation action for the price of one. It's Lots and Lots of Jets and Planes.
You can order now and receive a free bonus CD of Jet Plane songs. You must be 18 years or older to call 800-829-8866. Parents, call 800-829-8866. Satisfaction guaranteed. That's 800-829-8866 for Lots of Jets and Planes.
Yeah, I thought I was really struck by sort of the amount of loneliness in this book that I think I still haven't sort of like met. I read this and I feel like I still haven't read it. Like I feel like maybe I need to I should have reread it a few more times. In that I just don't, there's something very, very tragic about it, about this little boy and his first, it didn't occur to me right now, but until right now, but I think the very first thing he says is, please draw me a sheep. I know that because it's such a huge influential text, there's lots of academia around reading it and interpreting it. And people want to say, you know, this is this and the rose is his wife, Carmen, or whatever, and couldn't love her well enough. And I don't know any of that. But yeah, I was just because I was a very, very, very lonely child. And I think sort of the interesting thing about this is that loneliness is not a thing that really can be solved in a grand scheme. It's a thing that is always kind of there and lived with. The thing that, I mean, struck me the most is this sequence near the end where the fox comes in and they're talking about being tamed and everything with the rose as well. But sort of that, like, things are special to you, not because they are unique in the entire world, but because they're special to you because they are special to you, because they're unique to you, because it's the time that you have wasted for your rose that makes your rose so important is the line I have down.
It's, you might have thought it was unique. Turns out it's not, but that doesn't mean that it isn't special. That is something that really struck me on this read of it, because something that I say a lot is like when I really enjoy like a piece of media specifically, I kind of don't like talking to other people about it because I'm like, no, it's special to me for its own reasons. And I'm sure you like it too, but like, I have like my own thing going on with it. And like, I don't really want to like, we don't need to get into it together, you know?
Yeah. Because there's like such vulnerability in that, in that what if they say something that I don't like? What if they say something negative, even though like we're talking about that's, as soon as Wicked came out, I posted on multiple platforms, like, if you have a negative thought, don't tell me. Like if I just can't be around it, I just will not be around it. And I totally understand that because it is, I think, especially when it is like a young, like you were talking about something from when we're young and those things matter so much. It's so difficult to have those sort of little things poked in it. Even now, I'm like, Buffy was one of my most central, most formative texts, and I can't engage with the criticism. And there's really valid criticism of so much, and I can't do it.
No, I can't do it. For me, that thing is, I was actually just recently listening to your episode with Carly O'Brien about A Christmas Carol. And for me, that thing is, there is an adaptation from the 70s of Christmas Carol, a movie adaptation that's just called Scrooge. My family used to watch that movie. I mean, still does every year on Christmas. And I don't fucking want to hear it about Scrooge. Is it good? No. But is it great? Yes.
Yeah. You know? A movie called Lisa Frankenstein came out about a year ago. Mm-hmm. My favorite film of all time. I saw it 3 times in theaters. And my boyfriend likes to go to the movies with me. And I was like, I actually don't think you'll like it. and I don't want to share it with you because I want us both to be happy. Like, there's things of like, I love the movie Moulin Rouge. My boyfriend doesn't. That's okay. But that's a thing that like I've always loved, and I've had time to be an adult about it. And something that was just like, I know we can go in and go out and still love each other, but like, I want it to be mine and safe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And so it's kind of like he loves his flower. And so like he's like, oh my God, she's alone up there. And what I love about this is that, you know, obviously this is like an incredibly fictional story, but what I love that feels so authentic about The Little Prince is the way in which the stakes are so high to him. He's
Yeah.
like, I have to get back. I have to rake out my active volcanoes. I have to protect my flower. What am I going to do if the sheep eats the flower, idiot? That just feels so like true and authentic to childhood. Yeah.
It's a couple times throughout the book that was maybe the most heartbreaking part for me is that the rose only has four thorns. They reassure themselves as best they can. They believe that their thorns are terrible weapons. And then he's fretting about it in some of the final pages. And he's like, my rose only has four thorns. And yes. With those sequences, because the book is about, you know, the prince caring for his flower and his planet, and then the pilot caring for the prince, reading it, and obviously I'm in my late 20s and I didn't read it when I was younger, but I am sort of like, this feels a lot more like a book about parenthood than it does about childhood. There's so much wanting to protect. Yeah.
Yes. The way that we want to take care of each other. Yes. And I was just looking for the thing that similar to that, that struck me is when he is talking to the geographer and the geographer says, because flowers are ephemeral. Mm-hmm. He says, what does ephemeral mean? And he gets really caught up on what is ephemeral? What is ephemeral?
Yeah.
And he says, it means which is threatened by imminent disappearance. Is my flower threatened by imminent disappearance? Of course. My flower is ephemeral, the little prince said to himself. And she has only four thorns which defends herself against the world. And I've left her all alone where I live. That was his first impulse of regret.
Yeah, I think I would have moments where I was sort of pulled into that and then be like, actually, what's going on here? Like what? And it's not a book about a plot. It's a book about feelings and emotions. And I feel like, if you're a kid, that's what it is. You know,
right?
That makes a lot of sense.
Oh my God, my flower. I left her, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I like the way that both for the pilot and there are like possible kids that he could have like based the little prince on. And I don't think it's like an actual, it's this kid, but he hung out with some of the Lindbergh kids. But I think like something really beautiful about spending time with kids, I think, is that it really like whittles down everything else to, there's this one paragraph that is familiar to something else and yet I can't place it. The night had fallen. I had let my tools drop from my hands. Of what moment now was my hammer, my bolt, or thirst, or death? On one star, one planet, my planet, the Earth, there was a little prince to be comforted. I took him in my arms and I rocked him.
God, just like the love in that, like kind of abandoning all other things for this one most important thing, just feels so real.
Yeah, and important, and I don't know, it's a scary thing to be alive and be a person. And so I think also there's like, when you're a kid, your feelings are outsized. You don't know how to handle them yet. You don't know what to do with them. And I think just like, I just think about that action of, you know, of a person seeing a kid being like, oh, actually none of this matters. And I literally dropping everything to go comfort. And that, I mean, that is, it like hurts. It's so beautiful and does so much just thinking about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It reminds me of like something that I used to always say as a preschool teacher, something that I am learning to reckon with in my nascent career as a mental health clinician is love is part of the job description. Yeah. Where it is my job, like when it is your job to care for children, whether that is as a teacher, whether that is as a parent, as, you know, a family member, a babysitter, or as a therapist, in so many ways, it's about carrying these things for them because childhood is so big and so scary. And so allowing them brief moments of reprieve to just like carry those feelings for them just feels like such an honor to be able to do that. Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah. And that's, oof, I'm crying again. That's so beautiful.
because
don't be sorry. That's such a beautiful thing of the, but also like that, that the love is part of the job description and that you have decided to make love your profession, you know,
yeah.
for the kids who need it. And
yeah.
That's, yeah. Wow.
I always say I've never met a kid I didn't like. And listen, I have met kids I didn't like. But that's not their fault. They're
yeah.
kids. I'm always telling kids, there is nothing you could do to make me mad at you. I am 29 years old. How crazy would it be if a 3-year-old had the power to make me angry?
That's a really good way to put it. Yeah.
I think that's why I keep coming back to this text and why it continues to mean so much to me as I have aged and as I have taken on these new responsibilities as an adult, is just how important childhood feels to me and how I just wish to protect that, the sanctity of this beautiful and terrifying time in everybody's life.
Yeah, and that it should be our responsibility as adults to put the fence around the rose, just to take those
yes.
fears away.
Yes,
yeah.
absolutely.
Oh, yeah. And he goes on this process of visiting all of these different people on different planets, and each one of them is deficient in one way or another, or maybe not deficient, but certainly perplexing. But
yes.
One of the ones that he really comes upon that seems reasonable to him is the lamplighter, because he is doing something for someone else. So I thought it was really beautiful.
I love the lamplighter. Honestly, I love all of these little vignettes where he's visiting the different grown-ups on different planets. I think that some of them are so silly. And like, I think that so much of it is so beautiful, but so much of it is also just like hilarious.
Yeah.
And there's something about his writing style where everything is so matter of fact, regardless of the absurdity, that just like absolutely speaks to me. Yes, the king. I love the king. He says, here's a subject. If I were to command a general to turn into a seagull, and if the general did not obey, that would not be the general's fault. It would be my own. I love that.
Yes.
That feels so good to me. And God, the only one of these that I really don't fuck with is the geographer, which I know that I just, I know that I just like quoted the geographer, but like that one just like doesn't speak to me as much as like the king, the drunk.
Crazy. But at the same time, kids know alcoholics. Those are around.
Yes.
Come on.
Yes. That's like, let's put real things in kids' books. Children are people. We can respect them and trust them with heavy things. Love that. But yes, this lamplighter, and I love the illustration of him. He is so, he looks like a clown. He's got this big red nose. It's quite possible that this man is absurd, but he's less absurd than the king, the very vain man, the businessman, and the drunkard. At least his work has some meaning.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's this sense of logic that is throughout the book that doesn't feel like it feels like logic for children, but maybe not for me, and that's okay. But I think with the lamplighter, like, he starts to get that logic mirror back to him of well, why have you lit it just again? And he goes, well, those are the orders. I don't understand. There is nothing to understand. Orders are orders. Good morning.
Yeah.
And that's it. And I and I think like that's sort of the same kind of pattern that you see at the beginning with the pilot and the prince of, oh, okay, well, here we go. You don't know what's going to satisfy the logic, but once it is, we're on board and we can go ahead.
Yes. It's Resolving conflicts between
Mm.
preschoolers is one of my favorite things, honestly, because it's like I wanted to play restaurant, but she says that the restaurant is only for dogs. And it's like, okay, how are we going to solve this?
Right.
And they think about it and they think really hard and they're really working on that problem-solving skill. And they're like, I could be a dog. And it's like, yes, the restaurant is for dogs and you're a dog. Go. And it's as perfect as it ever was. And I think that that's kind of that like nonsensical logic that you're speaking to that just feels so authentic to childhood. It's
Yeah.
just so wonderful.
And while we're talking about it, I'm thinking like, well, no, there must be a logic behind it. And maybe the whole logic is just being like, yes, I see you have a problem and I'm going to treat it as a problem.
Yes.
And maybe the answer doesn't actually need to be anything, but I respect you enough and your feeling to give you an answer of some kind. Yeah, maybe that's
Yes.
it. Yeah, there's a real like kindness and dignity to this that I guess I sort of
Yes.
didn't expect.
It's a way that I aspire to communicate with children in this way, where it's just like, take their shit seriously, you know? It's made up, it's weird. Sometimes you're gonna think that it's pretty dumb, but it's real to them. And so, you know, they have the capacity to ask a question and they should be dignified with an answer. Whether or not it feels like it really matters to you, it matters to them. And so if you have to make something up, you know, not like fabricated, but like if you have to like because it's too cold outside to have ice cream, you know, that kind of thing, that matters. Give them an answer. The worst thing in the world to be a kid and somebody's and you say why? They say because why, you know?
He asks for a sheep, and the pilot says, "I can't draw a sheep," and that doesn't make the need go away. But he says, "Okay, well, here's a box, and the sheep is inside. Like
And he's like,
I have
yes.
tried to fill it." Yeah, and it's that trying that is what matters. Yeah, I don't know what it is about the artwork that makes it so iconic. It's something about that little boy. I don't know. He's small, but I think everything feels sort of like maybe accurately proportioned.
He's small, but he's big, you know? It's
He's
like
big on
he's
his
a
planet, that's for sure.
right. He's a little tiny guy, but he's big. I used to work at a preschool where they had windows that were child height, which just felt so
Perfect.
wonderful and respectful to what they're going through, where it's like I have also worked at many preschools that have adult height windows, and anytime something's going on outside, kids need to be lifted up. And it's like, no, just like accommodate their true reality. I love like child size versions of products that you never would have imagined a child needing. And it's like, yes, this is their reality. This is the world that they live in, and they deserve things that fit them.
Yeah, there's a reason that anyone I've ever talked to about, it feels wrong to call them museums, but in Pennsylvania, near where I grew up, there was a museum, might still be there, called the Please Touch Museum, that wasn't any actual like exhibits, but it was like play in a grocery store, play in a farm, play at a tea
Yes.
party, and all of those things being, I mean, the having like a kid-sized grocery cart. That grocery store was the best thing in the world. And I think it's
Yes.
like you're saying, it's because it's on your level, it's on your height. You know you are still small, but for a day you are indulged to be big. One of the illustrations that I loved the most is the fox at the beginning of Chapter 21, the fox appears out from under this hill. That does not look like a fox. That looks like maybe a kangaroo, but I respect it. But he's like coming out of the hill as if he's coming out from under a blanket. The grass has moved so he can crawl out from under it. And I love that because it's
Yes.
like, we know they live in the ground. I don't know how they get out of there. But here's an idea, you know?
Yes.
Here's an
Yes.
idea.
I also love your criticism of the fox because it is very similar to the Little Prince's criticism of the fox. Your fox, his ears look more like horns and they're too long.
I did forget about that.
That's another one of my favorite things is kids are so blunt. Today I was in session with a fourth grader who wanted to play tag with me while we, you know, were working through our session, and I could not catch him. He was very, very fast. And he kept being like, "You can try, you know." And I was like, "I am trying. I'm trying so hard."
My boyfriend said that to me about bowling the other day, and I had to be like, "No, man, I'm just this bad at bowling. I'm
Like,
just really bad."
this is just what it's like. I was working at a summer camp and a kid asked me, "What do you look like without your glasses on?" And so I took my glasses off and she made a face like, "Ugh," and goes, "You can put them back on now, please."
It's the police punctuating it all.
It's like, okay, I get it, you know.
I've noticed in some of the quotes you've read, like the translation can be a tiny bit different here and there. So I wanted to ask, when he meets the fox, for me, it's after that second illustration, the fox says, "Please tame me." I love that. I can't stop thinking about that.
Yes, I love all of the stuff with the fox. So something that I was thinking about a lot to completely pivot away from like us talking about the dignity of
Yeah.
childhood.
Here we go.
When I was a kid and reading this was in the era of when I was an actor. And I used to, in all things, think when I was reading, when I was watching anything, if this were a play, who would I want to play? Unilaterally, it was the fox. I badly wanted to be the fox. Something about that character was always just like the most compelling part of this to me. And it still is. Like, I think that, like, the parts with the fox are where it really kind of gets to the heart of what this book is about.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, like the fox does have the most famous quote in the book about, you know, like you can only see with your heart.
Oh, and not with your eyes.
Yes,
Yeah.
that's like the big one. But let me see.
Yeah.
Okay. How it is in my translation. It was then that the fox appeared. Good morning. Yes, he says, "I can't play with you. I'm not tamed." What does tamed mean? They go on. "Yes, please tame me," he said. "I'd like to."
Please tame me. Before that, to tame, it means to establish ties, which I thought was such a, because it, I that's not how I would define tame, or like when I think of to tame something, it is exerting control, it's dominating.
Yes,
Yeah.
tame feels like such a, like, I do not generally like that
Yeah.
word. Like, it
Yeah.
feels like to demand obedience in some way. And
Exactly.
so, in like his description of it, I'm like, okay, you know, like if that's the definition that the book wants me to rock with, then like, yes, we should all be taming each other.
Yeah, I love that it's like it could be a mutual thing in that way. That establishing ties is there's no dominance, it's a neutrality. Because then it's sort of like, yeah, my boyfriend and I have tamed each other. And you know what? In ways we have. And isn't that sort of the beauty of love is softening each other's hard edges?
Exactly. And that's another thing. I don't know if you want to put anything in the pod about the movie, but that is like
What are
another
we like?
criticism.
Yeah.
That is another criticism that I have of the 2015 movie is that the fox is voiced by James Franco, who
Oh.
I hate in
Yeah.
general for many reasons, but regardless of your opinion on the guy, not the right vibe for what this character has going on. And there's something about the way that he talks that just makes it sound so gross when I think that it's actually such a beautiful and perfect thing that I'm just like, all right, get
Yeah.
him out of there.
Well, that's making me feel like, is it a cultural thing? Because I feel like I'm used to seeing foxes as like sly, devious,
Sly.
kind of trickster characters. And so I would cast James Franco as a trickster
As a
if I
fox,
thought, yeah, exactly, if that's what I thought it was. So not to like, not, we don't need to like do a deep dive into the cultural significance of foxes in France because that's not what it's about. But it's not what I normally. So when he comes in and he's new and he says, "Please tame me," I'm like, okay, this is a setup. But it's not. It's just like it's there, which I think is really nice. Like no one in this world is, I think in this novel, like is devious, I think.
Yeah, like you could make an argument for the snake, but I think that the snake is mostly just like doing his job. You can't really be mad at the snake, you know? He's just there. He's like, listen, you want to go home? I can get you home. He's maybe a little sketchy, but he's not like duplicitous.
He's very forthright about there's no like morality tied to this snake, I think. He's just like, I have a job and I do it, which is also nice. It's yeah there's
Kind of refreshing, hey?
it's refreshing to be in a story where, like, I mean, everyone is absolutely speaking more or less at face value, and I just wish that were adulthood, you know? And I that's a beautiful thing about kids, I think, is and that when we can, like, I think you've really like met a person in a really deep and pure way when you're like, we can actually just put those down and we can just kind of, we don't have to be trying to do anything other than exist here, I think is. Yeah, it's like people who are.
And you know, I think that it is really like representative of childhood because I feel like the only characters who say anything other than exactly what they mean are the grown-ups, are these people that he meets on all of the other planets.
Oh, this was something. I'm going from the end back to the beginning. When I drew the muzzle for the little prince, I forgot to add the leather strap to it. He will never have been able to fasten it on his sheep. So now I keep wondering what is happening on his planet. Perhaps the sheep has eaten the flower. And there he's starting to do what the way that it's written, at least to me, does reflect those things we were talking about earlier. But like, but my flower is on my planet, and what if she gets eaten? And that sort of that structure and that kind of intensity to it feels so like a kid.
Yes. I'm responsible for my flower, and he feels responsible for the little prince. Yeah, just kind of like taking in that logic and like making it your own. And I think that shortly, I believe shortly before that, yes, because the little prince has not yet returned to his planet, slash maybe died. Like you'd think it's a snake bite, right? But I would say that probably my favorite quote in the whole thing is your fox's ears, they look more like horns and they're too long. He laughed again. You're being unfair, my little prince, I said. I never knew how to draw anything but boas from the inside and boas from the outside. And he says, oh, that'll be all right. Children understand. God, I love that.
I know that sometimes there's writing and discussion about this book from like a philosophical perspective, where I think sort of we I something I am always sort of hyper aware of when looking at books for kids. Every author is different, but I think that because it's a text that I'm most familiar with, The Wizard of Oz is you know one of my foundational texts. And
Of
people
course.
love to say, well, you know, the yellow brick road is for the gold standard and the Tin
Yes.
Man is for the silver standard. And it's like, no. This man was not writing for you. He was writing for children. Like
It's a
the
yellow road and it's a tin man, you know? Like
Exactly.
there's also a lion who talks.
And if you want to like really get into some deep Wizard of Oz lore, there was like a school in the town where L. Frank Baum grew up in that might have had yellow bricks in the front patio or something. Like maybe it's that at most. But I think like trying to, you know, assign, well, his wife is from this country in South America that has three volcanoes. And I think all of that is sort of, we can't pull out a full and complete set of answers from this in like an adult logical philosophical framework.
What it reminds me of is those things that people love to share. I mostly feel like you see them on Facebook where it's like, did you know that actually SpongeBob, all of the characters represent different mental illnesses? Or
Yes,
like
Winnie
they'll
the
be like,
Pooh, yeah.
they'll yes, or they're like Winnie the Pooh, actually all the characters are dead. They're Christopher Robin's hallucinations. And it's like, no, they're not. That's not what
They're
it is.
fun. Yeah.
It's fun. It's talking animals because kids deserve nice things.
Yeah.
I don't know what the desire is to make these things dark and adult and like evil.
Oh, I like that. I think it's a fascinating phenomenon to think about because I think it's like you always want to cling on to these things that matter to you as a young person and bring them with you into adulthood. You know, that's something I love about Wicked. Maguire writes this book and is able to like talk about all of this incredible, amazing stuff. Like the 1995 novel talks so much about religion and political influencing and there's a war and all of this stuff. And I think there's that desire to bring it with you. But I think also it's kind of a thing of like, this is a little too prescriptive, but it's like I was innocent and I ha went through pain to learn. So now, if I go in and I like put in darkness there, then I could have somehow foreseen it. Or it's like trying to go back and find a way of like telling yourself things that you ha had to learn, like trying to skip
Yes.
over that painful growing process.
And you know what it feels like is like very similar to the adults who are like, well, my parents spanked me and I turned out fine. It feels the same as like that energy of like, oh, like we don't need to do all that. Like, I don't think that you did necessarily turn out fine if you're an adult who's advocating for hitting children. It's kind of like a reach, but it is like that same kind of energy, I feel.
And I think it's something that this book does particularly well is just sort of let the feelings sit. When I hear what you're saying of like, you know, well, I got hit as a kid and I'm fine. It's like you shouldn't have been hit as a kid, full
Yes.
stop. I am sorry that that happened. Like, let's take as long a moment as we need to feel that sorry.
Yes.
Everything else can be separate from this because that truth in itself is full and formed and isolated and must exist on its own and be respected as such. You know, there's,
Absolutely.
like you said, like kids know about hardship. They exist within hardship. Sometimes the best thing you can do is say, it's here. It does exist. We are existing
Yes.
in it, you know.
Yes.
Because I don't think Sanctuary had like a this is the moral of the story kind of takeaway. I think like that could be put in, you know, a finite main idea sentence other than like treat each other with dignity and respect. Like it's even more than kindness. It is what can you do for another person? What can you give? How can you recognize a need and try to how can you just try to make something better?
Which, like, I think that the beauty of that is that so many people might think that that's naive, but I think that people think it's naive and people love to say things like, well, the world's not fair. And I say, like, okay, that doesn't mean that you have to be unfair.
Right.
You can aspire to be better.
Yeah, and that the world is actually each made up of a lot of individual people. And if we say
Right.
the world isn't fair, it's, well, okay, well, I want to try to make mine a little bit more fair. Like I only
Right.
have this little bit of the world in myself, so I'm going to do what I can with it.
Sure, it is true that life is not fair. That does not give you like a get out of jail free card, like a permission slip to be cruel. We owe each other a lot as people. It is our job to take care of each other. And that's what the book is about to me.
And it's interesting that a book that I think is, at least in my mental image, so much about isolation. I mean, maybe it makes sense that it's also about how you interact when you're not in that isolation, which I guess, I guess that makes sense.
I think that it's like, it's these characters who are very lonely, who are like, okay, I have seen what true loneliness is like. This is how I'm going to treat people as a result of that.
For some reason, I think I thought that maybe this was from the perspective of the Little Prince. I don't know if I really knew that at first or not. I like how it's not about how did this guy come to this planet? How does he want to get back to the planet? Because I think you look at we messaged a little bit about the 2015 film, which I haven't seen. And I think you said they sort of pull it out to be, a 2 hour kind of story. And I think the thing is that a screenplay that is good to an adult is not going to be good for a child, Like there's And so, I think the thing that makes this book really successful is it doesn't focus on the technicalities of how do we get from here to there to here to there? What planet is he from? How does that work? But we're on the emotional ride, and that still hits all of the beats.
It's told almost like a dream. It's like you don't know how we get from point A to point B. You just suddenly are at point B, and it's like we don't need to worry about it. You're just there. And I think that's really wonderful.
Yeah, I think that's what's makes it successful. Those are always the interesting things about how what works in a story better for this audience versus that audience, I think is something, 'cause at least I went to screenwriting school, and I think it's so silly, but I think in most screenwriting programs that I'm familiar with, there is not like a writing for children's media anything. And I think that's so dumb. I think partly just from an act like a money standpoint.
Just like a be realistic.
There are so many kids shows out there. Like there's so much out there.
I think there's so much talk in this book about like grown-ups taking themselves too seriously. And I think it's another example of that. It's like I would never deign to, and it's like, okay, I would.
Those are the moments that are really beautiful and freeing. We were talking about that kid asked if you have trains at home. I love toys. I'm 27 and I love toys.
Love toys. I love toys. I mean, I could really wax poetic about all of the emotional reasons that I decided to go into play therapy. But honestly, I just really like to play. It's just so
Good.
fun. I want to put a doll in a dollhouse and I want to put it in the bathtub and then it gets ready for bed. I want to build a train track that has a duck pond in the middle and you can pretend like you're in the train. Passing the pond and all of the passengers wave. I want to build a really huge structure out of block and then pretend that that's my house and I live there and I'm the princess and I'm wearing a pink dress and I'm 7.5 years old and my name is Princess Jessica. I want that for myself. And Erin, I want that for you.
Thank you, Princess Jessica. From one Princess Jessica to another. I'm really glad I read this. I read an ebook of it, and it is something I would like to have a physical copy of, because I think it's something that you can't just like have on a shelf and sit down and be like, I need a page or two today. I need some wisdom. I think it's absolutely something like that. I was sort of, I think anything that is this like revered, and I think there is a little bit of like a pinkies up, it is French, so it's like extra special. I'm so glad that it has such earnestness to it. I think that's so important.
And I haven't read it in a while. I think the last time that I read it was probably undergrad. And that was a point in my life where I was still like, damn, I would make a hell of a fox. And to now be at this phase of my life where I'm thinking of it from a completely different perspective feels like a real gift to the person that I am now and a gift to the person that I was then. I love my young self. She was something else, but God, I love her.
Yeah, that's I that's something I'm really on. Something creeps up into your mind about like, oh, I can't believe I did that when I was young. And then suddenly being like, actually adorable. Let's find it cute. Let's
It's
find
like,
the
no,
beautiful thing in there.
that's so sweet.
Well, I'll toss it to you. Do you consider it required reading?
Oh, yes.
At least once in your life, sit down with a nice warm cup of tea and a cozy chair and read this sweet little book.
Not a cup of tea. Sit down with a damn cup of hot chocolate. Honor your young self.
So many marshmallows. Like, why do you have to leave that younger version of yourself in the past? They come with you.
Absolutely required.
Where would you like, would you like people to find you? Where would you like to be found? Do you have anything to plug?
I don't have anything to plug, and I'm not really posting these days. If you want to follow me on Instagram, that's perfectly welcome. I'm at Go Kelp Go. Find me or don't, it's fine.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so fun. I just love this podcast. I love this concept. And I just love you. And I'm so glad to get to talk to you again.
You so much. I'm going to pause the, I'm going to stop the recording so we can gush. Thank you so much, Kelsey. I'm again trying to fit this under a minute. I hope you guys like the little treat I left in this episode. Next week, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory with Darren Simpson. You can find me everywhere at Aaron R. Bowles. I need to go paint a picture frame, a painting frame, some more. Please support the podcast at buymeacoffee.com/required reading. I love you.